Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Reflections. Pope Benedict reflects on his four-day visit to Britain last week and reiterates his admiration for the life and writings of the new blessed Cardinal Newman. Papal visit feedback. The Archbishop of Liverpool, Patrick Kelly, assesses the impact of Pope Benedict's UK visit. Lagging millennium goals. With this week's focus on how to give fresh momentum to the drive to achieve these UN goals, we hear some shocking statistics from Caritas Internationalis that illustrate how far we are off track. And Niger's need. Almost half of Niger's population desperately needs food, and up to one in six children suffers from acute malnutrition. And one Catholic aid worker recently returned from there talks of how people are reduced to eating millet husks to survive. At his weekly general audience, Pope Benedict reflected on his apostolic visit to Britain last week and stressed his long-standing admiration for the life and writings of the Church's new blessed, Cardinal John Henry Newman. The Pope also prayed for progress at this week's meeting in Vienna, continuing the ongoing theological dialogue between the Catholic and Orthodox churches. Emma McCarthy reports.
In a packed and overcast St. Peter's Square, the Pope told pilgrims that his journey marked a new phase in relations between the Holy See and Great Britain.
And I wish to send my affectionate greetings to all those I met and those who contributed to the visit through the media during four days, which have begun a new and important phase in the long-standing relations between the Holy See and Great Britain.
He said the trip to the UK was an official visit and at the same time a pilgrimage to the heart of history and of today, during which he spoke to the hearts of the people in the UK and they spoke to his, proving that Christian heritage is still strong and still alive in the nation. He then went on to retrace the highlights of the four-day trip, beginning in Edinburgh, where he was warmly welcomed by Queen Elizabeth.
Later that day, I celebrated Mass in Glasgow in the presence of many bishops, priests, religious, and a great concourse of the faithful against the backdrop of a beautiful sunset at Bella Houston Park.
Next, his arrival in London, where on Friday 17th he visited St. Mary's University College and spoke of Catholic education, pointing out the importance of faith in the education of mature and responsible citizens. His recommendations to young people not to pursue limited objectives, contenting themselves with easy options, but to aim for something greater. There, on the grounds of the college, the Pope also met with representatives of other religions, where he repeated the unavoidable necessity of honest conversations, which he says requires the principle of reciprocity in order to be fruitful.
Later, I had the honour of calling upon His Grace the Archbishop of Canterbury, who has come on several occasions to meet me in Rome. Our meeting at Lambeth Palace, in the presence of the bishops of the Church of England, was very cordial and fraternal.
Later in his audience, the Holy Father returned to the theme of ecumenism when he called for prayer for the success of the current plenary session of the Joint International Commission for Theological Dialogue between the Catholic and Orthodox Church. This session is discussing the role of the Bishop of Rome in the Universal Church, with particular reference to the first millennium of Christian history. On Wednesday, Pope Benedict said obedience to the Lord Jesus, as well as consideration of the great challenges that present themselves to Christianity today, force us to engage seriously in the cause of restoration of full communion between the churches.
I then crossed the river to Westminster.
Returning to his visit to the United Kingdom, the Pope also stressed the unprecedented opportunity he was given to address both houses of Parliament, the celebration of Mass in Westminster Cathedral, with a liturgy he described as evocative of the best of the English musical tradition in the celebration of the Roman Rite, as well as his visit on Saturday afternoon with the elderly residents of the Poor Clare's residential home, St. Peter's in Vauxhall.
So I also had the chance to thank and encourage souls charged with the safeguarding of children in Britain.
But, concluded the Pope, the culmination of his visit was the beatification of John Henry Newman, an illustrious son of England. The vigil for the beatification itself in Hyde Park on Saturday evening left a profound impression on the Holy Father.
That evening I participated at a beautiful vigil of deep prayerfulness and stillness at Hyde Park with tens of thousands of the faithful.
And finally, Sunday, a great moment of deep personal satisfaction for Pope Benedict XVI as the Church celebrated the blessedness of a great Englishman whose life and writings he has admired for many years and who has come to be appreciated by countless people far beyond the shores of his native land.
Blessed John Henry Newman's clear-minded search to know and express the truth in charity, at whatever cost to his own personal comfort, status, and even friendships, is a wonderful testimony of a pure desire to know and love God in the communion of the Church.
Pope Benedict concluded, "His is surely an example that can inspire us all." I'm Emer McCarthy.
Feedback from the Pope's historic state visit to Britain is continuing to ripple across a wider and wider area. Among those present at Wednesday's general audience in the Vatican was Archbishop Patrick Kelly of Liverpool. And he spoke of how the warmth and humility of Pope Benedict during his UK visit last week touched hearts and minds.
From the very beginning, there was a warmth, there was a gentleness, there was a serenity which has been very special. I was privileged to be there when the Queen welcomed him to Holyrood Palace, her official residence in Scotland. And the atmosphere was one of total courtesy, total friendship, but also of total truth. For me, it was almost a moment of tears when this German Pope gave thanks to this country for what it did to rid the world of the horror which was the Nazi story. And on his final Mass in Birmingham, he referred to the fact it was the 70th anniversary of the Battle of Britain. And again, he gave thanks for that and particularly spoke with sympathy for the people of Coventry, which suffered terribly in the war. That's a courtesy, that's a humility, which I think won hearts across the whole country.
Archbishop Kelly also assessed the impact of the Pope's keynote speech to Britain's political movers and shakers in London's Hall of Westminster.
For me, in many ways, and I notice in the Holy Father's words at the general audience today, he gave special significance to the meeting in Westminster Hall, which was very much the meeting with politicians and those with responsibility in civic life, both for the nation and internationally. And when he entered that hall, the warmth of his reception was quite incredible. And when he'd spoken, the applause was full of enthusiasm. And what I heard everybody saying was, cynicism is not right, negativity is not right, discussion and division, which is simply bitter, is not right. We can and we will build a good society. That came through loud and clear.
So does Archbishop Kelly believe that the papal visit helped to confirm that Britain and Europe do have a Christian soul?
I think that shone through, and of course it is very interesting. We are a very strange country that we have a monarch, and which is very clear to all of us. The Queen takes very seriously the ceremony when she became Queen, which includes an anointing. She sees it as a sacred moment. So that's at the very heart of our understanding. But it also seemed to me that precisely because of the strength of the witness to our Lord, whom we proclaim as the Saviour of the world, only wisdom like the Holy Father could we have had the gathering, which I was involved in Twickenham, of representatives of the other faiths and religions. It was a remarkable gathering. The depth of the Holy Father's words were received with great warmth, and all those who took part, they afterwards expressed extreme gratitude. There was a sign of, if you like, the Christian soul of Europe being precisely a soul which enables dialogue with everybody.
That was Archbishop Patrick Kelly of Liverpool. Other enthusiastic feedback from the Pope's UK visit comes from John Newton, press officer for the Catholic charity Aid to the Church in Need, who attended the beatification mass for Cardinal Newman in Birmingham last Sunday.
I think that there's two things that would stand out. First of all, Coughton Park, the mass of beatification, which I had the immense privilege of being able to attend. That was just a fantastic experience, being there with the Holy Father, celebrating mass with, I understand, more than 50,000 Catholics, and beatifying John Henry Newman. But also that prayer vigil on the Saturday, watching that on the television, and when the Blessed Sacrament was exposed, you could feel the silence. It was just palpable to be broadcasting absolute silence on the television, where you could hear a pin drop. And it really said something, you know, that obviously everyone in the park was just absorbed in Jesus Christ present in the Blessed Sacraments on the altar. And to see that televised on British television was something you just never expect to see. That was just an amazing and profound spiritual moment.
John, now, of course, you're speaking from the point of view that you are actually a British Catholic. This visit, what has it meant to you?
I think it's meant an awful lot, especially being able to be present there and to see that the Holy Father, having come to Britain, having come to England and to Scotland, that the visit of a Pope is something absolutely extraordinary. It's something that you don't expect. I never thought when Benedict was proclaimed as Pope that he'd necessarily ever visit Great Britain. So to actually have him visiting the country, I think that's an extraordinary gift to the British Church. And I think it's been very exciting. I think it's been very energizing. And it's also been very affirming in the faith. Sometimes you can feel that, you know, in the day-to-day practice of the faith, things can get you down and, you know, you can sort of wander. But it really has been a call to renew the faith, to really focus again on Jesus and what's really important in the faith. And no, it really has been absolutely fantastic. I can't say more than that. It's been brilliant. It really has been.
Will it be a little bit easier to stand up for your faith and hold your head up high and say, yes, I am Catholic in British society now?
I think it will be easier to sort of argue that the church's position on things in society. I think there has been a feeling in the church within the last 5 years that the views of not only the Catholic Church, but of most faiths are being sidelined as a more sort of aggressively secularist approach sort of takes over within British society. And I especially think the remarks that the Pope made before he left, just as he was finishing his journey, about the need for Britain as a sort of secular society to be pluralistic and to take the contribution of faith on board, and the sort of noises that the Prime Minister, David Cameron, was making about the role of faith in society. I mean, it bodes well for a future in which the Catholic position and the Catholic viewpoint, and indeed the viewpoints of other faiths and religions too, can be taken more seriously in the public debate and in the public arena. So from that perspective, I think it's going to be very positive.
That was John Newman, press officer for the charity Aid to the Church in Need, speaking to Emma McCarthy.
There are people dying. Oh, it's time to lend a hand to life.
This week, the spotlight has been directed at the lagging drive to achieve the UN Millennium Development Goals, aimed at reducing world poverty levels. The goals have been set back by the global financial and economic crisis, which has prompted some rich nations to cut development aid as they try to reduce record budget deficits. Along with other NGOs, Caritas Internationalis has urged rich nations not to use the economic crisis as an excuse to shirk their responsibility to provide justice for the world's poor and vulnerable. The head of communications at Caritas Internationalis is Patrick Nicholson, and he told us to what extent the international community is off track in its bid to achieve these Millennium Development Goals.
We've only got 5 years left to achieve the Millennium Development Goals, and for many countries, they are terribly off track, in some countries centuries off track. So really we want to see increased energy and enthusiasm behind making those development goals happen. If we can get supporters of Caritas around the world to pressurize their governments to provide the aid that's needed and to make some of the reforms that are needed, we could see a real effort towards achieving the Millennium Development Goals.
One of the areas that Caritas has always focused on, one of the many goals that have been set by this whole initiative, is cutting child and maternal mortality. Has there been any achievements in this area?
Well, in child mortality, there have been some achievements. The figures have lowered a bit, but they really are terrible. One in seven children in Africa don't live to see their fifth birthday, and 8.8 million children died in 2008. And it's really just four diseases, pneumonia, diarrhea, malaria, and AIDS, which counted for about half those deaths. And with low-cost preventions for those diseases, it really is a shocking statistic. I think maternal mortality is perhaps even worse, where you've seen really no improvements at all in maternal mortality in Africa, where one in 22 women die in childbirth, and the day a child is born is often the day the mother dies. And that really, those two are really the shocking goals which are way off track and really need focus and attention.
Of course, the Millennium Development Goals is something that's been very close to the Holy See's heart, to this particular Pope's heart. He wrote an entire encyclical on the idea of social justice and development. What is preventing these promises from being fulfilled?
They would say that the economic recession really has put a huge constraint on their budgets. And that's perhaps true. The problem was during the economic boom period, the governments which had made these promises didn't fulfil them.
That was Patrick Nicholson of Caritas Internationalis speaking to Emma McCarthy. Right now, many people in the African nation of Niger are suffering from a grave hunger crisis, and some in the worst affected areas are reduced to eating virtually inedible food like millet husks to survive. Aid groups say almost half of Niger's population desperately needs food, and up to one in six children are suffering from acute malnutrition. Land Hartrill of Catholic Relief Services recently returned from a visit to Niger, where he travelled to some of the worst affected areas. He told me how poverty is at the root of this hunger crisis.
Right now, the hunger crisis in Niger is severe, and it's been compounded by the fact there was flooding there. So people have kind of been hit with a double whammy. They have been experiencing drought since last year, and then the flooding that has happened has made things even worse. The biggest problem, I think, right now is that a lot of people not only don't have anything to eat, but they have also lost a lot of livestock. There's something around 80,000 livestock have been killed in the north of the country. Nobody knows how many in the south, but over 100,000. And livestock in Niger is key to livelihoods. So people don't have goats or sheep or cattle, and so they have no money to buy food. The interesting dynamic is that there is actually food in markets in Niger. It's just that no one can afford to buy it.
So is this a crisis that is only partly caused by, you know, recurrent drought and failed crops? It's also primarily perhaps because of poverty?
Yes, poverty is the basis of what's happening. People live on the margins in Niger. And during the hunger period, when crops should be growing and food stocks should be lasting, people have no reserves. They don't have money to go to the market to supplement. So this is what we're seeing right now is people don't have any reserve cash. They have sold off their animals. A lot of men have left villages and gone to major cities to try to find work. This affects the family dynamic. And when I was there, I met women. Their husbands husbands had left and promised to send money, and they hadn't yet. So the wives had been forced to sell off animals and try to feed their children. And right now, a lot of women that I met were eating essentially food that was meant for livestock because they couldn't afford the sorghum that they would normally eat. So they were forced to eat millet husks. There's almost no nutritional value in that. It's just something to put in the stomach. So it's severe and very worrying what's happening right now. And from my perspective, it's very bad and will probably get worse before it gets better.
Hartrell went on to describe some of the most harrowing sights he saw during his recent visit to Niger.
When you drive along the principal highway, you see carcasses of animals all over the place. So that was very concerning. I met some farmers who their cattle are literally collapsing, and they would go out with a cart, lift the cow into the cart it back to their home, and hand feed it in hopes that it would recover. But there's just no forage. There's no food for the cattle to eat. I saw many children that were malnourished and needed more food, and that was distressing. Catholic Relief Services is actually handing out food vouchers, and they are allowing local villages to come and redeem the voucher and pick up food. And in that package of food, there is high nutrient food specifically designated for children. That's a big concern. The malnutrition rates of children are at alarming levels right now. Women who are breastfeeding don't have enough milk for their children. Some of them are forced to drink water. And another X factor is a lot of areas in Niger are dangerous to go to. There's militants, there are bandits, the security is very bad. So some areas are too dangerous to go to, and those populations are very much in need of help.
You mentioned the security risks in Niger, and of course we've got this ongoing feared kidnapping of 7 foreign workers by Al-Qaeda militants. Do aid workers and aid organisations like CRS fear that these incidents like this could impact on the willingness of donors to give money to help the people of Niger who are suffering?
I don't know if the militancy that's happening in the Sahel affects donor dollars. I would hope that people realize the need going on in Niger and the number of people that are desperate for help. It's clear that the militants do have an impact on humanitarian work, but agencies like Catholic Relief Services and others do our best to serve as many people as possible throughout the country, but we also have to take care of our own people. So there are places in Niger that we don't go to because they are too precarious. And the Nigerians in those areas need help just like everybody else, sometimes more so because it's often in the north of Niger where the situation is most unstable. But I would hope that donors realize that NGOs are doing their best and really analyzing the security situation to make sure they cover as many people while still taking care of themselves.
So what would be a typical meal for a poor family in Niger, in the areas worst affected by the hunger crisis? Hartrell again.
When I was in Niger, people were starting to eat what's called anza. Anza is a very dry, bitter fruit that grows on a bush. In normal times, people would not eat that. Animals, camels, would typically not even eat it. It is very bitter. It's very acidic. But because Nigerians don't have food, they will pick this fruit and they will soak it multiple times to try to get as much of that bitter taste out as possible, and then they'll eat it. And I met a few people that were doing this, and there were reports of many others doing it. And that, again, comes down to the fact that they don't have money to buy food, and this is what they're stuck with. Other women that I met were eating millet husks, which is very dry and bitter. And the woman I talked to said she eats that so her kids can eat sorghum, the sorghum they have left over. And this is what people are resorting to. Adults are eating food that is not fit for animals, so their kids can eat the food they have left.
And when you talk to some of these people, what's their mood like? What are they saying about this situation?
When I talked to Nigerians, the mood was kind of resignation mixed with desperation, and there was also a lot of resilience. Nigerians have lived through drought many times. This one happens to be worse than many others. Now you compound that with flooding in pockets of Niger, and so they're doing the best they can. I'm always surprised at how resilient Africans are, and Nigerians in particular, when you've resorted to eating bitter fruit and husks, and you still have a smile on your face, and you still say, well, we'll figure out a way to get through this somehow. That always impresses me.
And whilst on the subject of being impressed, Hartrell told me about one woman he met who exemplified that courageous resilience.
I met a woman outside of Dogondoochee, which was a main center. I went to a very remote area, and the woman, she had three children, and her husband had left, and she was eating millet husks. And I asked her, where do you think this is going? Well, what do you think this is, what's going to happen? And she sort of put it in the hands of God. She said, it's up to God to sort of decide our fate, and he will help us. And she also mentioned the solidarity of the village. This is also an important factor in the crisis that's going on, is that people really help each other. If someone has food in the village, they will share it. The village chief was very clear that if he did receive food, it would be shared amongst the most needy. So there is sort of a glimmer of hope there, that people in some of these very affected areas are in solidarity with one another, and they're helping each other with the little they have.
But given the frequency of drought and crop failure in Niger, what does the future look like for the people of this nation?
It's hard to say how the hunger crisis in Niger is going to play out. What I can tell you is that there are a lot of NGOs, humanitarian organizations, mobilized and acting and distributing food and putting people to work. Catholic Relief Services has a big work program where we actually pay people to do projects, and this puts money in their pocket, and they're able to buy food. And this is very, very key. What's going to happen in the coming weeks and months is hard to say. What I do know is that unless the root causes are addressed, we will see this happen down the road in coming years, because, as you mentioned, it's the poverty that's really at the root of this, and that needs to be addressed in a serious way so people have stable incomes, have stable livelihoods, so when these shocks hit, there's cushion and they can respond to them. So we can feed people and we can help people, and it's going to help in the near term. But in the long term, 5-10 years down the road, there needs to be a mentality, a poverty reduction mentality. And this is what a lot of humanitarian agencies are doing right now. We're thinking about this. We have programs that address this, and hopefully it'll work out for the Nigerian people.
I was speaking to Land Hartrell of Catholic Relief Services about his visit to Niger. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.